Hi, everybody. Welcome to Fireside Chat number
258.
I want you to understand that except for one, which drives me crazy to this day, it's 258 consecutive. During the entire lockdown period, we didn't miss one. I'm very proud of that fact because we lived a normal life, unlike most people, which saddened me terribly, but I'm not going to get into it because I could easily get into that. I'm Dennis Prager. Oh, so of course, let me explain. It is Snoopy for the first time, 258 times, and the first time he is in Otto's bed. Otto is in front of me, and I have no idea why they swap places. So Snoop, you have big shoes to fill. His expressive self. Okay, everybody, I got a great thought for the opening. I want to thank Megan, too, for this. So I went over with you, and oh, God, it went viral on the internet that I attacked the sign in some elementary school class. What was it again? Let me see. The world is great,
better,
because you are in it. Mm-hmm. And I don't like that type of stuff. First, who's the you anyway? Because all of them, anyway, I'm not going to review. I wrote an entire column on this, and the attacks on me were quite ubiquitous on the internet. Prager attacks fifth graders. That was a common, yes, Dennis Prager attacks fifth graders. Like, that's really important to me to attack fifth graders. I'm attacking the message, not the fifth grader. But if I say that there are fifth graders about whom that's not true, the world is not necessarily better, then I'm attacking fifth graders. So Megan here decided to look up another subject. What are the messages of our society to people on any given subject? To her credit, she came up with, you came up with the idea, right?
But I just expanded
on the list of what
topics you wanted to circle back to
about having flaws.
Yeah.
Did I mention that?
Yeah, you mentioned
it. Oh, okay, great. Well, anyway, Megan did her homework well, and I verified this. I Googled, what did I exactly Google? Flaws and imperfections.
Quotes
about flaws. So these are the top ones that came up. All right, here are the messages of our society. To you and me, this is not the fifth graders. This is to us about our flaws. Ready? Your imperfections are what make you beautiful. So I don't know, should I'll read them all and then analyze, I think, because it builds up into some crescendo. Embrace your imperfections. They are what make you. Okay, so you just see that it's graphically designed. Next. Your flaws are perfect for the heart that is meant to love you. I don't even understand it, let alone agree with it. But it doesn't matter. That's what came up. Here you go. Next message in our morally demanding society is everyone's perfect in unusual ways. Who comes up with this stuff? And then finally, better a diamond with a flaw than a pebble without. And what else? I myself am made entirely of flaws stitched together with good intentions. And then finally, there's a new adjective, you're flawsome. That's so beautiful. It's better than awesome. Flossing. I thought it had to do with flossing, but I was wrong. Okay, so let's analyze these here. Why I'm not a fan of these messages. Your imperfections are what make you beautiful. That's not true. It's simply not true. It's actually your wonderful traits that make you beautiful. I don't know. Aside from not morally demanding, because I assume they mean character flaws. I don't think they're thinking of physical flaws. And that's particularly impossible with physical flaws. Your physical flaws are what make you physically beautiful. It's just silly. So it means character flaws. But it's not true. Your character virtues are what make you beautiful. If your imperfections are what make you beautiful, then the more imperfections, the more beautiful you are. That's quite a message. You know, I'm not there yet. I really need to cultivate some more imperfections. All of these messages are part of the crisis, I really believe, of our society. That is not, it doesn't make moral demands upon people. That's why I was against the self-esteem movement when it began. I was very young, but I was already in media. I actually interviewed the man who came up with the self-esteem movement. I remember his name, John Vasconcelos. You could look it up. He was a Democratic, not shockingly, state senator in California. And he grew up Catholic and he said, oh, it was too rigid. I didn't grow up with high self-esteem. I was taught I was a sinner and so on. So I went to therapy and I got much better through therapy because the therapist cultivated self-esteem in me. So I know that's what everybody needs is self-esteem. Okay. I think self-esteem is great if you earn it. But we'll leave that for now. Next, embrace your imperfections. They are what make you. What does that mean? Embrace your imperfections. Okay, here is the message, and this is ironic because I am making this fireside chat the week of the holiest day in the Jewish calendar, Yom Kippur, or Yom Kippur, as it is often called. It's called the Day of Atonement. Now, the Day of Atonement is the opposite of embrace your imperfections. It's literally the opposite message. It should be called the Day of Embracing Your Imperfections. But it's really the day of trying to confront your imperfections and reducing them. Nobody can get rid of them completely, but the beautiful human being works on their imperfections and tries to lessen them. This is the opposite of the Judeo-Christian message. The opposite. Embrace your imperfections. They are what make you. Really? Is that how you think of anybody in your life? I would think that it's clearly part of what makes us. Of course that's true. If you're missing a leg, people know that you're missing a leg. But whereas what you do is you work around it to make a beautiful life. But if you can, you get a prosthetic device, right? You don't embrace the absence of a leg. You try to undo the damage of a missing leg. So there's two not only meaningless, but bad messages. The next one. Your flaws are perfect for the heart that is meant to love you. Boy, somebody really had to work hard on that one. First, I'm not exactly sure what it means. Your flaws are perfect. In other words, the heart that is meant to love you finds your flaws perfect. Do you find your flaws perfect? Does somebody else? Does your spouse, if you're married? Do your kids? God, I love my mother's imperfections or flaws. God, thank God for Dad's flaws. Who says that? The heart that is meant to love us loves us despite our flaws. I agree. But not that the flaws are perfect for the heart that loves us. Every one of these messages is a bad message. Everyone's perfect in unusual ways. I know what they mean, but first of all, again, it's just not true. First of all, no one's perfect. So even allowing for hyperbole, what does that mean? Let me make this clear. every one of us is closer to perfect the more flaws we get rid of. That's the way it works. The idea of embracing your flaws is a bad idea. You can embrace your idiosyncrasies. That's a separate issue. I don't think you have to fight your idiosyncrasies, but we're talking about flaws. That means character flaws. By definition, we want to get rid of them. What was the next, though, that finally, the last page of this? Better a diamond with a flaw than a pebble without. That's true. But that isn't a case for flaws. It's a case for diamonds. It's hilarious. Yes, it's entirely true. It's like saying better $1 million with $100 of counterfeit bills than $1 that isn't counterfeit. That's true. It doesn't make any point. I myself am made entirely of flaws. Let me just say this. If you are, I probably won't get that close to you. Nor will anybody else. Oh, stitched together with good intentions. That's probably my least favorite of the messages. I did an entire PragerU video on the general worthlessness of good intentions. The amount of evil done in the 20th century by good intentions is much greater than the amount of evil done by sadists. People with good intentions supported the greatest mass murder movement in history, communism. Killed 100 million people. Believe it or not, there were Nazis with good intentions too. I know it's very hard for the unsophisticated mind to grapple with that fact. Not every German who voted for the Nazi Party wanted to exterminate Jews. They wanted to improve the horrible German economy. And there were people, there were Germans with good intentions that, oh, Jews, they believed the message. Jews are our misery. Intentions are, I'm sorry, intentions don't mean anything. Behavior is everything. Since I'm on the Yom Kippur mood, I was just in preparing for my talks that I gave at my synagogue, I again came across a truly terrific idea in the second holiest work of Judaism called the Talmud. This is thousands and thousands of pages. It's like a giant encyclopedia from about 1800 years ago. And it's arguments and theology and philosophy and morality and theology. It's got everything in it. And one of the most amazing comments in the whole book, the whole encyclopedia, is this. The Jewish belief is that you're born with a good desire and a bad desire, or inclination, if you will. It depends on the translation, which I like, because they're always in conflict. My bad inclination tells me to do this. My good inclination tells me not to do this. And it's very good. From a very early age, I knew I had to fight my bad inclination. But the rabbis, the ancient rabbis said, it's a good thing we have a bad inclination, which sounds bizarre. Said, without a bad inclination, a man wouldn't take a wife, wouldn't make a family, wouldn't do his work, wouldn't build a house. And I remember when I first learned this as a kid thinking, then what the hell is the good of the good inclination? It seems like the bad inclination did all the good things. But they're pointing out, one of the things they're pointing out is that good intentions don't really lead to all that much good. It's good to have good intentions, but without wisdom, without knowing what good is, they're useless. So this is a particularly obnoxious one. I myself am made entirely of flaws stitched together with good intentions. If that's who you are, whoa, you are a dangerous human being. You're entirely flaws stitched together with good intentions. These are the messages that are being sent out today. There's nothing about moral improvement. All of my religious upbringing, and by the way, this is true for Christian kids too in solid Christian schools, is about getting to be a better person, confronting sin. That's the term that Christians would be more likely to use. Jews might more likely to use flaws. Doesn't matter. It's the same idea. You've got to overcome the bad stuff that's in you. Well, why do Catholics have it's called the sacrament of reconciliation, confession. Why do they have confession? If you follow this, you'd go to the priest. You're a Catholic. You'd go to the priest and say, "Hey, I got great news, Father. Well, listen to all the flawed things I did this week." Right? Why confess flaws if they're so terrific? Then you wonder why society's in trouble. It's very, very hard to make good people. It's the hardest thing there is. It's easier to make good rocket ships to the moon than it is to make good people. It's very tough. That's what society's project should be. Would you say this, by the way, about a car, now that I'm talking about it? You know, great thing about my car are its imperfections. What would you say it about? Okay, that's our messages. All right, we go on to your questions. All right, take it away.
Hi, Dennis. I'm Samantha. I'm 28 years old, and I'm from Ventura County, a little town called Simi Valley. My question for you is, as a Christian, is it wrong to question so much of what God is trying to tell us in the Bible and Proverbs and everything?
All right. Thank you, Samantha. One second. Let me see if I can get this right. I didn't. All right. I got it right on the second try. By the way, little town in Ventura County, Simi Valley is a pretty major place. By the way, you will be shocked, Samantha. When I moved in my 20s, when I moved from New York City to California, that was the first place I lived. It was tiny. It was like a village. In order to get a full meal, you had to go over the mountains into what was called the San Fernando Valley, still is. There were two restaurants in the entire Simi Valley when I moved. So it's touching to me that that's where you live. It's not a small town now. So let's see. Is it wrong to question so much of what God is trying to tell us in the Bible? So here's an interesting observation that you may not be aware of. The name of the people of the book, the Jews, is Israel, right? That is the people, the children of Israel, and so on. When does Israel become a name? Well, the story is that Jacob, the third of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, wrestled with an angel and was given the name Israel because you wrestle with God and you wrestle with man. Israel means wrestle with God, argue with God, struggle with God, however you wish to put it. It is built into the biblical idea that if you believe in God, you will wrestle with God. That is a live mind. So you're perfectly fine with questioning, if that's your word, what God is trying to say in the Bible. However, I have good news, which is why I work so hard on my Bible commentary, the Rational Bible. I've spent my life questioning, but here's the interesting part. I've always believed there were answers. And I was right. That's why I'm writing my commentary, because it gives answers to difficult things. I'll give you an example. There's a law in the Bible that a child who is particularly terrible to his parents should be taken to the court, and if found guilty, the child will be stoned. To most readers, that sounds so primitive as to invalidate the Bible generally. But I came to realize something. The law was brilliant. For the first time in history, this Bible, remember it's 3,200 years old, this Bible said for the first time in history, parents cannot kill their child. That's the point of the law. The point is not kill your child if he's terrible, if he's awful. The point is you can't. You have to take him to a court. But no court ever sentenced an Israelite child to death. So they maintained parental authority, but dropped it completely when it came to taking a child's life. That is an example of, yes, I question too, how could there be such a primitive law? It turns out to have been an incredible moral advance. And I do that repeatedly. It's why I ache for people to read my Rational Bible. The third volume is coming out next week, Deuteronomy, the fifth of the first five books. I think that there are answers to all of these questions. And on the rare occasion I don't have an answer, I acknowledge it. But generally, and not generally, in virtually every case, there is an answer. So it's fine to question, providing you look for answers and know that they're there. Abigail, Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Dennis. With midterms around the corner, what is your position on political yard signs? That's funny, midterms. I thought she meant exams. Midterm elections. We recently moved from Atlanta to the suburbs, and our new next-door neighbor had a BLM, Black Lives Matter, sign in her front yard. We have daughters around the same age, but I have felt hesitant to be more than neighborly toward her based on her perceived values. Thank you for your time, Abigail. I think you should be super-duper-duper friendly with your neighbor with the BLM sign. I mean it sincerely. First of all, is a great rule of life when you are not sure how to act. Always switch the shoes, as it were. Wear their shoes. So, for example, let's say there would be an opposite broadcast to this one from somebody on the left. And they wrote to the person doing their fireside chat, you know, they had a Trump sign or they had a pro-life sign in their yard. How should I act toward them? And I would want my neighbor to act very nicely toward me if they differed with my politics. And that's how we should be toward them. By the way, all it does, if you don't act nicely, is confirm their suspicion that conservatives are not nice. You should shower them with love. That's why I'm not joking. Now, if they're obnoxious, fine, I understand that. But let them enter the world of cognitive dissonance and tell their friends, you know, I got this conservative neighbor and they're really nice. That'll throw them for a loop. All right. Ethan, 22 years old, Pleasant Grove, Utah. Hi, Dennis and gang. That's you guys. My wife and I love to travel. However, we find some of the most convenient times for us to travel are when our families have things planned. We love spending time with our families and value time spent with family, but are not sure how to prioritize travel versus family time. What advice do you have for us? Thank you. Well, Ethan in Utah, oh, you're already married at 22? Good man. The wise decision. Here's my answer. Your wife comes first. Protect your marital relationship. It's the single most important relationship in your family. It's okay if the rest of the family doesn't have a trip with you as often as you would like. It's infinitely more important that you and your wife get along than anything else in family life. I'm adamant about that. On my radio show for decades, I have told couples, get away with one another as often as you can. It's very nice to take trips with the kids, but the kids grow up and leave the house, and it's nice if they have those memories. On the other hand, it's even nicer if mom and dad got along well. Okay? So I'm pretty clear on that one. Seijin, 33, Tokyo, Japan. Hello, Mr. Prager. My question for you is, have you ever lost in a debate? That's a good one. And if so, how did you recover from it? And what did you learn from it? I ask this because now that I'm more outspoken as a conservative, I know I'll need to debate people more. How do you speak English so well? Because it is a Japanese name. Do we know him?
He was on your radio fundraiser.
He was on the fundraiser, yes. So that's right. He's Japanese-American, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Right, but he's in Tokyo. Let's see. I know I'll need to debate people more. I do want to learn how to win, but at the same time, I want to know how to not get crushed by my defeats. I understand that searching for the truth is not easy, and I want to toughen myself up. Thanks, and God bless you. Okay. So let's see, have I ever lost in a debate? So that's an interesting question. I remember on one occasion, and it's interesting, it was not a live debate, it was done on the internet. I didn't think I did as well as I normally do. Otherwise, I've generally always felt good after debates, but it doesn't matter. Everybody loses. There's no such thing as not losing. There's only one way not to lose, and that is by not competing. That's the only way you don't lose. But if you don't compete, you don't get anything done. So if you lose, you have to figure out what you could have done better. I'll tell you one general rule that I have tried to follow, and that is don't be the yeller of the two people. If you're the calmer one, it usually is very, very much more effective. But you have to learn the issues. There are a lot of traps you can fall into in debates. I'll tell you one because I've debated so much because I often debate callers to my radio show. I have found, and I don't believe they do this intentionally, people that I debate, whether they're pros or they're amateurs, as it were, callers to my show, they often change the topic. And it goes by the audience. It sails by. The people don't realize what they've done. And I try to call them on it. Wait a minute. You're changing the topic. So let's go back to the point you made earlier. I'm asking you a question about that or something like that. So anyway, yes. You may well lose a debate. It is not a reason not to debate. There's another great Hebrew saying that was on the walls of my classroom, again, from the book, the Talmud. And I tell you, I learned a lot from the signs in my classroom. And I didn't learn that the world was better because I was in it, by the way, or to embrace my flaws. This was a great line. It actually did deeply affect my life. The easily embarrassed does not learn. I'm translating from the Hebrew that it was on the wall. And that's what enabled me to learn my language as well. Because when I started speaking, I realized I'm making silly mistakes or what sound like silly mistakes. But when I realized, don't get embarrassed, Dennis, I was totally at peace speaking a language imperfectly. So they would correct me. So what? Do you find somebody from another country who speaks your language anything but admirable, even if they make a million mistakes? Okay. Let's see here. What's our timing? It's 30 minutes. Oh, I got another one. Where's the other one? Oh, yeah, from Norway. And I'll take the Norwegian. Put the Norwegian on top for next week. Well, folks, I can't believe it. Snoopy was here the entire time. You see that? Plus ça change, plus ça la même chose. The more things change, the more they're the same. Actually, it's not true, but just like to say. Anyway, it is a change, but at least we had a canine pal in Otto Spot. Wonderful to be with you. See you next week from my home to yours. Thank you for being with me.